The more couples know and love each other, the more they must believe in the person loved, in his incommunicable reality, in his hidden richness, in that inexhaustible treasure that is nourished at the very wellsprings of creation. Indeed, in the measure that we love and know, in that measure must we believe. 2. This first point of comparison remains somewhat abstract. A much more concrete obstacle has opposed itself both to union with God and conjugal union from the early dawn of humanity. This obstacle does not affect the essence of the human condition, but it is nevertheless written in every page of its history. Its daily repercussions are immense and have no other limits than those assigned to it by the redemption of Christ. And that obstacle is sin. The progress of the believer is constantly contradicted by evil. Anarchic tendencies riddle his will and tempt it away from the influence of grace. The crushing seduction of a thousand idols overwhelms us. Repeated sin deadens the force of our good intentions. A kind of sense of futility poisons our effective faculties. Saint Paul suffered because there were two laws within him. Our intelligence is similarly undermined. Satanic voices persist in obscuring the validity of spiritual values. The cross becomes a scandal and a folly. The things that reason cannot justify by its proper light lose their supernatural character and become unreasonable. The magical charm of what is purely human scoops within its narrow confines anyone who begins to doubt the eternal. Grace can be lost, unfortunately, and the vows of solemn consent can be broken, or at least rendered impotent, for such is the risk of a union with God that depends upon faith, the perpetually menaced faith of a poor sinner. The accord of wills and intelligences in married life experience the same form of crisis. As descendants of Adam and Eve, we are always coming up against the limits of interpenetration of creatures. Between married couples, sin introduces a permanent principle of rupture, and even apparently modest shortcomings are far-reaching in their harmful effects. Because of the effects of sin, wills set themselves against each other, for the role of evil is to dislocate, to separate, to tear asunder. Souls become at certain times impermeable because the same evil exacerbates individual personalities, marks out their differences, fires their egos and snuffs out the faint circle of light that has been found after much struggle. Then the suffering of an enigma is not something in the outlying regions of experience, on the fringe, as it were, of the fabric of love, but it is something which pervades everything. A frightful doubt then makes its presence felt. Have I made a mistake? Will this thing work itself out? Shouldn't I seek happiness in something else, if not in someone else? Fed on the deceptions inherent in this way of life, the imagination wanders off into greener pastures and the curtain of dark fear falls on what was once a beautiful love. We are not referring only to the obviously disruptive manifestations of mortal sin such as adultery, impurity, anger, injustice, tyranny and pride. The strategy of evil is more subtle. That such flagrant sin attacks the very foundations of conjugal faith either by completely breaking the bond of consent or by diminishing its quality, is evident. But to sin against God, independently of each other, is not less disastrous. If the guarantee of the conjugal bond is divine grace, each time that life is extinguished, each time that the soul of one or another of the married persons falls from the state of grace, the strength of love is weakened. Married couples cannot love each other with all the richness of their sacrament when the mainspring of their love is paralyzed. Man is not divided. If in his professional and social life, he shows himself dishonest, greedy, merciless, then God will no longer be at home in his heart. Experience with souls drives home this truth to every priest. Every sin is a sin against love. 3. Other obstacles to divine friendship, in the realm of faith, arise each day from the very circumstances of our Christian life. We cannot deny that the atmosphere which we breathe is pagan. Instead of finding in institutions, in the framework of our social life, some support in his journey towards eternity, the Christian is much more likely to find just the contrary. The world is Satan's accomplice. It is useless to insist upon that point unless it be for the purpose of underlining the nature of the conquest which faith must revindicate. This is especially true in our day when covetousness of the flesh, the eyes, and a mad scramble for wealth set themselves against the realities of the invisible with frightening conviction. Saint John compared the Christian soul to a battlefield when he wrote, "For whatsoever is born of God overcometh the world. And this is the victory which overcometh the world, our faith. Who is he that overcometh the world, but he that believeth that Jesus is the Son of God?" John 5:4-5. The sacred state of marriage is exposed to the same attacks. It is involved to the very end of life in identical conflicts. The personal sins of either of the partners undermine their love. That love must also protect itself from the multifarious enemy that is the sin of the world. We cannot overemphasize the importance of family missionary activity through real and efficacious infiltration into the heart of a de-Christianized world. Nevertheless, we must be wary of the slow erosion that operates through literature, conversations, films, the cynicism of some, the skepticism of others, deceptions and suffering of heart and soul. The inspired writer who repeated untiringly, "Little children love one another," terminated his epistle with a note of inquietude, "Keep yourselves from idols," John 5:21. This fidelity in all things which the Church asks husband and wife to promise on the day of their marriage, cannot survive the vicissitudes of each day except with the grace of God and the wholehearted cooperation of those who love each other. With a great number, unconsciously perhaps, a shifting of values, compromises, cowardly actions and a kind of subordination of their ideals to the ready-made judgments of a social environment, dissolve the basis of mutual faith. Little by little the dignity of the body is lessened and the blame for this or that betrayal is accredited to physical passion which, after all, is inevitable. Husband and wife then merely live together without any profound intimacy and rationalize their empty life in the name of practical impossibility of a total life in common. It is here perhaps that the deleterious influence of the world is felt more effectively. Fidelity in all things, the priest asked at the altar and the encyclical letter of Pius XI insisted on that fidelity in urgent terms. If marital fidelity and a mutual respect of bodies, faith of chastity, as Saint Augustine puts it, are present, the depth of marriage is much greater. What is needed, Gustav Thibon tells us, is absolute conjugal unity, and therefore the efforts of a whole lifetime of a habitual intimacy, of a society. He or she who believes that this communion is possible and who strives constantly towards it without ever sinning against love or hope, has conquered this world. We have merely suggested the obstacles to the two faiths which we have analyzed. The subject is immense. We have only sketched its general contours by means of three successive comparisons. But if such shadows do exist and such obstacles are present, how can faith subsist, either in the believer or in the soul of the married person? What assurance does either have of the reality of their consent? In other words, under what conditions is faith viable? Faith will be viable if total cooperation between God and creature is established, a conjunction of the treasures of the supernatural with the resources of everything human. Grace on one hand, and the intelligence and will of man on the other, are convoked to that meeting ground where salvation is worked out. Then there is nothing in us that cannot be enlisted in the success of this cause, nothing incapable of serving the interests of this enterprise. The mystery of marriage. Few Catholic couples live the full Christian reality of their marriage. A great number of them restrict their married life, as, for that matter, they restrict their whole Christian life, to a moral plane. They accept the responsibilities that the sacrament gives to marriage together with the mode of behavior dictated by the law of Christ. They submit to a Christian sociology of marriage. But all of this remains very exterior, in spite of the generosity, the authentic integrity, and sometimes even the heroism which such demands suppose. Now the Christian reality of marriage is fundamentally of the mystical order. It must be lived, to correspond to Christ's intention, on a mystical plane, taking its motives from the very reality of Christ, and its strength from the faith that binds us to Him. In these pages, I would like to develop this truth. Perhaps some among you will interpret my words as a kind of accusation, forcing you. 163. To admit the distance that separates the poverty in which you have lived your marriage until now and the richness to which you are nevertheless called. May this accusation, if such it be an invitation to reflection. It is never too late. I have known couples who at an advanced age have discovered the rich meaning of marriage that had never been explained to them as it should have been, couples who had never meditated upon their vocation, at once divine and human, either before or after having entered it. Marriage is a sacrament. We must bear this in mind to discover its mystical reality. Too often we limit ourselves to an inadequate and abstract idea of marriage, a means of grace or a means to have grace. To re-evaluate the meaning of a sacrament, in view of applying it to marriage, I here propose two lines of reflection. The sacrament is an act of Christ. Every sacrament is an act of Christ. It is not first of all a thing, and too frequently we think of it as a thing. In the sacrament, an action of the living and resurrected Christ is communicated to transform us and assimilate us to His own vitality. When the Church lives her sacraments, when I am the subject of a sacrament, Christ Himself acts with His heart and with His liberty. He gives Himself to me with all of His power, His love and His freedom and the great personal interest He has in me. Christ addresses Himself to me through His Church to act in me. This idea is most clearly seen in the Eucharist, but it is not only true of the Eucharist. We can say of all the sacraments that they are acts of Christ touching us personally, person to person. This is the first reflection that should be brought to our attention if we wish to have a very living and a very concrete, and the only true idea of the sacraments. A sacrament is an adaptation to human circumstances. The second reflection I wish to propose answers a question which you have perhaps already asked: why are the seven sacraments, since it is always the same Christ who gives Himself to us? Actually, from Christ's point of view, there is only one sacrament and it is Himself, the sacrament of the living God. But from our point of view, there are different circumstances. And Christ is not only interested in our souls but in our whole life. He reaches us and seeks to touch us and transform us in our concrete situation, in the whole scope of our human existence. And human existence is a multiple thing. It is made up of diverse circumstances and experiences, of life and death, suffering, love, loneliness, joy and work. These are the broad categories of human experience which men of all times in a variety of expressions must know, if they are to remain men. In these experiences the whole person is engaged. Hence Christ's action unites in us this diversity of human situations, which may be transitory or permanent, and the sacrament will be the ritual expression of this union. On the one hand we have a living act of the resurrected Christ communicating something of His own vitality to us, and on the other hand the concrete circumstances in which we live, the elements of our existence which we offer to Christ that He might complete them. All of the sacraments can be understood in this perspective. Penance, for example, takes us in our experience of weakness, in our consciousness of mendicant and sinner, the so-called sacrament of extreme unction, which should be called the sacrament of the sick, helps us in the situation, not of death, but of sickness, in order to give the suffering of our bodies a Christian meaning. Likewise the sacrament of marriage takes us in the most total and most sacred of all human experiences, that which most resembles what God is, since God is love. It is also the most fruitful of all human experiences because love implies the maximum dedication of persons. It is not astonishing that, if Christ wished to sanctify all of human existence, He gave particular attention to the privileged situation that is the love life of man.